time looks long, but it's actually much shorter than all of our other assignments, because we're now entering into an area where it's not so much my area of expertise, so that I can't make up such long problems, hopefully educate problems that are educational, but these are more standard problems, which are fairly simple and take longer than half a page rather than 3 or 4 pages. So even though it looks longer, it's really one of the shortest assignments of the semester. The material, actually on that again, the material that we're going to be starting to use is really covered pretty well in Mandel and Wolf, so that starting with the quantized field, I think that if you use the text, and I emailed you various sections that we're covering, I think that it'll help you and you'll be able to go ahead. In fact, one of the homework problems I think is actually solved in Mandel and Wolf. And also, the first volume of Cohn Tanucci's book on Introduction to Electrodynamics, Interaction of Atoms with Fields, on reserve at the Science Library, that also covers this material. But it's also covered in almost any basic quantum optics book. But before we get there, let's start. And just, I wanted to finish up again what we had last time on the Ramsey fringes. The physical experiment here developed by Ramsey is one in which you have something, an atomic beam, that passes through two field regions. And the idea here is to get a line shape eventually that will be narrower in frequency than you would have had if you did CW spectroscopy, and you would have been limited by the transit time, the amount of time the atom stays in the field interaction regime. Here we're assuming that the atom really doesn't spend very much time in the field interaction regime. We're assuming short pulses, but that there's a time interval between pulses, which in the atomic rest over Vx, where Vx is the longitudinal velocity and Vz is the transverse velocity, it'll be perpendicular in this case. So the idea of the experiment is you detune the laser field from the atomic transition by a certain amount. You send the atoms through, and you measure the population of the atoms just as they exit the field region. You can do this in a number of ways, field ionization, or just probing it with another, if it's in the RF domain, with another radio frequency field. Does everyone understand the experiment?
You do that for both fields, right?
Excuse me?
You check after each
field. No, you check only after the second field.
Only
after the second field, you check for the population. So just right here, you check for the population. And what's physically going on here? Both fields have the same detuning. All right. Normally, the way you would do this is you would take this field and send it down via some corner cube or something else and get it. In the case of optics, in the case of RF, you would have two cavities that you would be sending the atoms through, and you would have to link the cavities to make sure that the cavities have a fixed relative phase. So this is what's happening, and we want to measure the population. So physically, what's going on here? This is what, once you understand that, then I think things are fairly straightforward. What you're doing, what you're going to be measuring here is essentially a difference in phase. The first pulse actually starts a clock. You can think of it as starting a clock, pressing down on a stopwatch and starting a clock. And the second pulse then stops the clock. So which phases are we actually comparing with this start and stop? If you think of this way, you won't get confused, because a lot of times people get confused by saying, well, look, the pulses are off, we have the natural frequency here, how do we get anything in this experiment? If you think of it in terms of these clocks, I think you'll figure out what's going on. What phases are you comparing? There's only two frequencies in the problem, aside from Doppler shift. One is the frequency of the field. Well, you got them both, all right? One is the frequency of the atom, and one is the frequency of the field. And how much frequency does the, how much phase does the field go through in the time interval between the pulses?
I that length.
Well, think of it in terms of time, it's easier. How much phase does it go through? frequency is big omega, so it's just
omega
times T, big T. And how much phase does the atom, the dipole that you created, go through? If its natural frequency is little omega? Little omega times T. So what's the difference in phase? Just delta times T. So all you're doing is measuring this relative phase of the field and the atom, the atomic oscillator. And that's what a Ramsey fringe does, a measurement does. It takes and it lets you compare two frequencies. And this is very important because you can make laser frequencies very stable, and you're trying to get atomic frequencies maybe as a standard, as a time standard. So this lets you essentially get a very precise way, as we'll see, of creating some type of standard, time standard. And in fact, this is what's used now.
So there's no Doppler phase.
There is a Doppler phase. We have to look at it and see what's involved with a Doppler phase. We did that last time, but I'll review it again today. Any question on the physics? Once you got the physics, then the rest is mathematics, but it's really, and there are some important implications of the Doppler shift as well. So you have to look at that. Right, everybody, any questions on the physics? Right, start and stop of a clock. So the last time we calculated, in fact, what W is right after the second pulse. And that's, we're interested in rho 2 or W. It doesn't make a difference, really. And W is just sine A1, sine A2, and those are the areas of the pulse, e to the minus gamma t, cosine delta bar t, where delta bar equals delta plus kv perpendicular, plus kvz. And then there's another term which has cosine A2, but doesn't depend on delta. That's just essentially the part of the ground state that went through without getting excited. And we're not really interested in that. So we can neglect this part. Not that it's not there, it gives us some background, but it doesn't depend on delta. And remember, we're going to look at our signal as a function of delta.
But aren't you going to record that when you make the measurement?
It's a background, so it affects.
So how do you get rid of it? I mean, you have to have
it something. Doesn't make a difference. In other words, even if you have a background signal,
yeah,
that's a constant, and that's not what you're interested in. So it may affect your signal to noise, but it won't affect the shape of the signal. Just to add, it'll add a DC component to the signal. Right? Now, in fact, you can see that if you judiciously choose A1 and A2, you can actually make this term vanish identically as well. And if you take the first pulse pi over 2 pulse, and the second one, well, I don't know if you can make them both vanish here. If you take the second pulse pi over 2, this vanishes. No, it doesn't look like you make both of these. This is sine squared A1 over 2. So, but I don't think you can make both of these vanish and that one not be zero. But if you just take the second pulse, have an area of pi over 2, then this term vanishes anyway. Because cosine A2 would be zero. So we have to calculate the integral of this over velocity, and we need some velocity distribution. This is not in a vapor cell now. We have a beam. So there's some transverse distribution of velocity due to the divergence of the beam, the angular divergence of the beam, and there's some distribution of longitudinal velocities. If it were a monoenergetic beam, what would the longitudinal velocity distribution be?
I mean, just a constant.
Not constant. If it was monoenergetic, it would be a delta function. Will be delta Vx minus whatever the speed of the beam is. Monoenergetic means you have all the atoms have the same longitudinal velocity. Now, out of a thermal source, you don't get that. Out of a supersonic source, you can do a lot better. And you can use laser cooling techniques, actually, to get close to that. So I just took a simple distribution for the speed along the beam, Vx squared. Typically, in a thermal beam, it might be Vx cubed. Times e to the minus vx squared, just moves it out a little bit. But this is just a function that's peaked at some value related to ux. So we have to calculate the integral of cosine delta plus kv perpendicular times t And remember, T is L of Vx times W of V. And this is, again, related to integrals we've seen before, but the important thing is that let's look at KV perpendicular times T. And let's take some typical values. K is on the order of 10 to the 5th centimeters to the minus 1 in the optical. This is in the optical domain. Let's take a thermal beam. V perpendicular, let's take an angular divergence of 10 to the minus 3. That's a pretty small angular divergence, 10 to the minus 3 radians.
Why in the table now they have the exponential ux or u? Is that?
This is ux squared. Right, that gives us the most, that's related to the most probable speed along the beam.
But usually we have u squared now.
I know, but this is a beam. That's in a cell where u x squared average equals u y squared average equals u z squared average.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a beam that's collimated, the velocity in the transverse direction is very small. That's what you mean by a beam, right? So it's going all over the place, you wouldn't have a beam.
Mm-hmm.
And the velocity in the longitudinal direction is determined by the source. It's an oven, how the atoms come out along the beam. Right? So there's a different probable velocity associated with the longitudinal motion and the transverse motion. All right? So for V perpendicular, in fact, we take some theta, which is the beam divergence, times, let's say, 5 times 10 to the 4th or something, centimeters a second. And let's take theta about 10 to the minus 3. It's a very small beam divergence. So that's 5 times 10 to the 1 centimeters per second. And the idea in these experiments is you want to make T large. So let's take L about a meter long. Not atypical. So we take L equals 100 centimeters. And Vx is also, let's take it thermal, or Ux is 5 times 10 to the 4th centimeters per second. Mm-hmm. So if you multiply all those out, you end up with KV perpendicular T is on the order of 10 to the 4th. What does that mean? This is the Doppler shift that the atoms get because of their transverse motion interacting with the fields. Remember, they don't all have the same transverse velocity. We have to integrate over it. And what's for a typical atom, what about its Doppler shift, small or large? Compared to unity. This is a phase. It's very large. So as we integrate over V perpendicular, what will happen to all these phases? They'll just cancel each other out.
What are you telling us? You're asking us what that number means? Or what are you asking us?
In other words, this number is 10 to the 4th, but we still have to integrate. I just took a typical V perpendicular. We still have to integrate over V perpendicular. And since the phase for a typical atom is so large...
So you're saying the same thing that you said before, basically, with the phases...
In free induction decay.
Okay.
It's the same effect as free decay.
How does it compare with delta?
Delta is not... Delta is fixed. And we'll have to deal with delta also. There's another phase here that we'll have to deal with. But I want to look at this phase first. No matter what delta is, it's fixed. So when we average over V perpendicular, the signal washes out in the optical domain. So you can't do the Ramsey fringe for these typical parameters in the optical domain. And in fact, the original experiments were done in the RF domain, where in the RF domain, what changes?
Frequency,
so K changes. So K is about 10 to the minus 6 K optical. In the RF domain. And what does that mean about the total phase then? KRF, V perpendicular T is on the order of 10 to the minus 2 or so. So what about that phase? It's small and we can neglect it. So in the RF domain, what about the second term? We can throw it. And that's wherein he originally carried out his experiment. So we're left now with an integral of cosine delta L over Vx times W naught of Vx dVx.
Why are we looking in the RF domain?
We don't have to look in the RF domain. That's what the experiments were originally carried out. It's still an important domain because the frequency standards are cesium, for example, ground state transition. So it's a transition between the two hyperfine states of the ground state, which is in the radio frequency part of the spectrum. It's on the order of gigahertz. So that this is, in fact, the region where most standards have been developed so far. It would be better if we can get an optical standard, but we're not there yet because of other problems. So that this is a way to measure, for example, transitions between hyperfine states. Now, what if we did have a monoenergetic beam? What would this signal look like? In other words, if Vx, instead of being a distribution, as I wrote it, was just a delta function of Vx minus some Vx0.
So integration would be easy.
The integration would be trivial, but what would we get? Let's say it was delta Vx minus Vx0. Minus V0. Then when I integrated, what would I get? Cosine delta V0. Cosine delta L over V0. Well, what does that look like as a function of delta? So cosine, it looks like a cosine. But what's wrong with that for this experiment? Why isn't that good? You would think, boy, I'll do a lot better if I don't have to do this horrible integration. If I have a monoenergetic beam, I should get perfect results. But what's wrong? Why isn't this useful?
You have a problem with it's not confined to a point in space.
What are you trying to determine? What value of delta? When delta is equal to what? You want to use this to measure the frequency of the transition. So what value of delta do you need?
Zero.
Well, if I draw you a curve like this, which is delta equals zero? You don't know. So in fact, you want something that destroys all the fringes except the delta equals zero fringe. Is that clear? Population W, population, as a function of delta.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And I said that if this were a monoenergetic beam, we want to pick out the delta equals zero. But if we had a monoenergetic beam, we'd get a pure cosine. There would be no way to isolate which is the central fringe, the delta equals zero fringe.
Why do you want delta equals zero?
You tell me, why do you want delta equals zero?
Because you want to measure the...
If delta equals zero, what is the frequency of the laser equal to?
Equal to the omega.
Equal to the atomic. And that's what you want to measure.
Oh, okay.
All right? When delta is zero, what is this integral?
So
it's normalized. What's the integral?
One.
Just one. And then what happens? As delta starts to deviate from zero, you start to get oscillations, and what will happen eventually to this integral? As we integrate over it, it'll start to wash out. You have to do this integral numerically, and it's done in the notes, but it looks something like this. And what's the width? Approximately, what's the order of the width? It's when this phase, it's the value of of delta for which this phase is approximately equal to unity. And we put in the ux. So this width, then, in, as a function of delta, is just 1 over t, which is ux of order. So of order 1 over t, ux over l.
How do we know that gives us the width of the...
You do it numerically, you can measure it. But I'm just saying, here you have a phase. When do you start losing? When do you start getting things wash out? When the phase is of order? Pi, unity, pi equals, 2 pi equals 1, right? Right, for all these things, for large values of 1. Right. So you just get that's the order. You have to do it numerically to see where it goes down to 1/2 the... All right, so you can look on the notes and actually
it was
plot.
2 pi equals 1, they got
all right, 2 pi equals 1. If you remind me sometime when we're not being taped, I'll tell you a Feynman story about factors of 2 pi. All right. So this gives you a width that depends on what? As the length gets larger and larger, what happens to the width?
Smaller and
smaller. So it looks like you have arbitrarily small width. There's only one feature that we haven't mentioned so far, or I didn't put it here. We always have this e to the minus gamma t. Now, in the RF domain, that decay rate is very slow, so you can go on forever. But in the optical domain, if you had that, it would start to kill you very quickly, except in certain cases. I'll talk about that in a second. So here you can get very narrow widths that are not limited by transit time. It'll be limited by signal to noise, by drift, by keeping your phase of your laser steady, by locking your laser, by your frequency stability of the laser. Really, that's what the experimental problems will be. This is a very important technique. Any questions on the RF domain? We can do it in the optical domain, but not with this setup. And I'll show you how to do that right now. Any questions here first? You can measure RF frequencies, which are gigahertz or something like that. Well, you can neglect the Doppler effect. How can you do this in the optical domain? Any other questions? So let's see what happens. What was the main problem? Why didn't it work in the optical domain? Which I just erased. Because of the Doppler effect, the wipeout. So we have to do something clever to eliminate the Doppler effect.
The large Doppler phase.
And you already know how to do that in some sense. How did we eliminate Doppler effects in the past?
Two photon.
One is a 2-photon, and the other in the coherent transient domain. What was it? Essentially, we used a photon echo. Mm-hmm. Right. So we have to do something similar to that. So now, the idea is that we put in 4 pulses. The first 2 have wave vectors k1, and the second 2 have wave vectors k2. And these are the times t. I won't go through the details of this calculation, but I'll just sketch it very briefly to show you what's going on. What do the first 2 pulses give me for w? We've already done that. Gives me cosine delta plus k1 dot v times t.
Are we taking k1 to k2 to be in opposite directions?
No, not yet. We're just taking them arbitrary.
Is it really okay?
And what does the second pulse do, essentially? I put these very close together to indicate that we don't have to worry about what's going on here. So the second pulse just gives us another, the same type of factor. The only thing that changes is what? Delta plus k2 dot v times t. So you look up on the page in your head where you have the cosine identities. So this is cosine of delta plus k1 plus k2 dot v t over 2 delta plus cosine of k2 minus k1 over 2 dot dt. Now we need the delta. Why do we need the delta? We want to look at things as a function of delta. So we want to eliminate the Doppler effect. So what's the way is there to eliminate it here?
By picking k1 and k2 to be
opposite directions of equal magnitude. So if we take k1 equals minus k2, the Doppler phase goes away and we get a Ramsey fringe signal in the optical domain. Now remember, now we have this factor e to the minus 2 gamma t. And in the optical domain, if we want to make t large, what's going to happen there? It's going to start killing the signal. So where do you have to work in the optical domain? In fact, in almost all the experiments on optical Ramsey fringes up to recently were carried out for essentially forbidden transitions, transitions which have a very long lifetime in magnesium or cesium. They're not strictly forbidden, but they're almost forbidden. So they get lifetimes on the order of either microseconds or milliseconds. And again, these were proposed as standards, and people are still working on these transitions in magnesium and cesium, calcium and magnesium as standards.
Is there a reason why the decay factor is different here than it was in the RF?
It's the same factor, except we have two T's.
Okay.
We're always dealing with the dipoles between the pulses. Now, these experiments were carried out in the 80s, and then later on, Christian Bourdais gave an interpretation of these experiments in terms of atom interferometry. Now, this is a somewhat controversial area, and which I've been involved with a little bit, and Boris Dubetsky, who works with me, is much more emotional about these issues. And I'll come back in just a second and tell you why what the controversy is in terms of atom interferometers. You could think of this now, if we remember those diagrams in terms of recoil, we could think of these as two atoms going along different paths because of recoil and then recombining. So in that context, this could be as an atom interferometer. But to get this result, did we ever use anything related to quantization of the center of mass motion? Not at all. So ultimately or fundamentally, this result is not related to quantization of the center of mass motion, and it's not related to matter wave interferometry. In other words, treating the motion of the center of mass motion quantum mechanically. You can still use it as an interferometer, but it's what we call an internal state. It depends on the fact that you have different internal states, and you're looking at the interference between those states. And that'll become a little clearer in just a second. So this is a way of doing Ramsey fringes, doing interferometry as well, because, excuse me, what if anything affects the velocity in here? What about the velocity cancellation? Will it be perfect? No, so you can measure phase changes due to gravitational effects or rotation, and this can serve as a rotation sensor or a gravitational sensor. And the experiment's already been done in which those were measured. The question is it possible to build an interferometer when we're not so much interested in standards, so we're not trying to measure a frequency, but we want to have a very long baseline of time so we can carry out an experiment over a long time to get a higher precision. If we use the dipole moment, what are we always limited by?
Decay.
The decay of the dipole, excited state.
So what's a long time? You said we need a long time. What do you mean?
Long time, the longer the better, but let's say we want to get up to seconds or tens of seconds. What's the only state that stays around for that long period of time?
Ground.
The ground state. So we have to build an interferometer of this type that just depends on the ground state. So let me just sketch again how you could do that. Now, instead of putting in
four pulses. We only have to put in two pulses. But we put in standing waves. And then another standing wave. Let's see if you can get an idea of how this happens in terms of our little diagram. Here we have time. For the first pulse, what do we have acting? We start at state one, and we have both fields, think of both traveling wave components acting. This is just a sketch. I'm not doing this in detail. I'm just trying to give you a flavor for what happens here. Let's imagine we absorb from this beam, and we emit into this beam. You have to look up if you want to see this. Absorb from this beam, and then emit into this beam. How much momentum do we transfer to the atom? 2 h bar k. Remember, because when you absorb, you change the sign. If we absorb from this beam and then emit it into this beam, of course, the net thing would have been zero. But by doing it this way, how much do we transfer? 2 kV. And we could be either in the excited state or the ground state. If we do this twice, how much do we transfer? 4 kV, 6 kV, 8 kV, any power of kV. But let's just look at the 2 kV to see what happens. Lowest order perturbation. So now, and let's assume we're back in the ground state. What line should I draw now? Since we've got 2 kV of momentum, what should I draw? A line going up at 2 kV with that slope. But we're still in the ground state. Or the excited state. Well, that's a term. Remember, you go, just do it in perturbation theory. You start in the ground state. You go up to the excited state with one field and back down to the ground state with the second field. So we're back in the ground state in amplitude. So we have here a ground state.
So I understand your bottom picture. I think I understand what you're talking about. Well, you're talking about both fields acting at the same time. But
no, it's one. I'm just thinking of not both pulses acting. Each pulse consists of two traveling wave fields. It's a standing wave.
Yeah.
So they automatically act at the same time. It's a standing wave. I'm thinking of the standing wave as two traveling waves.
Standing wave pulses?
This is a standing wave pulse and a second standing wave pulse. Okay. But in this standing wave pulse, you have two traveling wave pulses.
So you're looking at one standing wave.
This is just the first standing wave.
Okay, all right.
This is just the first standing wave.
And we stay in the ground state, but we...
We can have some probability in the excited state as well. But I'm just following the ground state here.
Okay.
And now, what do we do with the second standing wave? Just as in the photon echo, we change it so that it comes back down. You would have to actually transfer 4 kV in that process to change its direction.
That's the second pulse.
That's the second pulse. This is at time T. So in the end, we've had a Doppler phase in a population. How do we get that Doppler phase in a population? By creating a modulation, a spatial modulation, 2k dot r. And then r goes like r plus vt. It's 2k vt. And then what have we done by the second pulse? We've rephased that modulation. And now you're sensitive to very small effects because you can use long time scales. However, there's one catch. I'll get to your question in a second, right? The catch is, remember when you did that homework problem this week, if you did it, for the stimulated photon echo. What's the only time you get a long signal? A signal that will last for a long time? When the system was open. And gamma 2 didn't equal gamma 1. So in order to get this to work, you need an open system. And that's not hard using magnetic substates. You drive on one transition, and it can spontaneously emit to another magnetic substate. So that works. All right, now, so I'm going to stop for a second, but you have a question?
Well, the diagram you've drawn looks like we're only looking at row 1-1.
Well, you have a row 2-2 as well.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
Or you have a row 2-2 as well.
We're always, in the past, we always looked at the difference, and now...
Here it's the same thing. We're still looking at the difference. In the second state, we have to be. We want to create row 2-2 now. This picture doesn't work so easily. We start in state 1.
To go to a 3 level.
Now I have to. I want to get another 2 that stays in the ground state, all right? So that I don't know if this is not going to work so easily in this picture, but I can have the same field act and leave me in state 2 also. If I have one field act, it leaves me, one field acts and acts again, it leaves me in state 2. So I can, to second order, this is not such a simple picture, so let's...
So I guess
let me think about that for the upper state.
My real question then is, if this sort of diagram doesn't always give us a good idea of which matrix elements...
This does.
It tells you one of the... Well, it doesn't tell you any wrong ones, but it doesn't necessarily give you a complete picture, right?
Well, I didn't give you a complete picture, but I can do it. I just have to think about it to get you the row 2-2. Remember, we did it with the simulator. We had both terms as well. We had row 2-2 and row 1-1. And I have to think about it. I'll try to bring it in next time to think of the row 2-2. But it's the row 1-1 that's critical, because that'll last a long time. Now there's another subtle way to open up the system, not simply by other magnetic substates. When you take into account recoil on spontaneous emission, that turns out that it also opens up the system to different velocity classes. So the recoil of the atom, we haven't done this yet, but the recoil of the atom opens the system. So in that case, we can get effects here that would be absent when we neglect recoil, but are present when we include recoil. So these effects are intimately related to what? To the quantum nature of the center of mass motion. And such interferometers in which you need that effect, you can really call the Broglie wave interferometers, because they really depend on the quantum properties of the center of mass motion. They in the limit that h bar goes to 0, these effects vanish. Where in the other interferometers, when you let h bar go to 0, all the effects still stay around. They're not intrinsically quantum effects, quantum related to the quantum center of mass. And we have a collaboration with a group at NYU, Tycho Slater, if you came to his talk here, gave the AMO seminar 2 weeks ago, or last week. And this is the type of interferometer that they've been looking at in their labs and have seen these effects of the quantization of the center of mass motion. So there's a lot of interesting physics here. We just touched on it. I just want to illustrate that you can use the techniques that you've learned, at least not that we didn't look at quantization yet of the center of mass motion, but we will. You can use the techniques that you've learned to analyze many, many situations that are very important. Any questions on this?
How do you say, consider recoil, it's open?
All right. Here's the 2-minute explanation, all right? When we neglect velocity, what do we know about row 1-1 plus row 2-2? Let's just say we have a 2-level system.
1.
That's equal to 1. Now, let's say we put velocity in. If there's no if there are no collisions or anything of that sort, we still have row 1-1 of V. Equals what? For each velocity class, equals some number. W and order V, all right?
Yeah.
All right? Now when we start to put in spontaneous emission and recoil, what happens? Things get a little strange. When you absorb radiation, which way do you recoil?
Which way does what recoil?
The atom.
Yeah.
You absorb radiation this way, the atom gets a kick this way. But when it emits it, which way does it emit it? It's in a lot of different directions, so we can get a kick another way. So that this condition no longer holds. It's no longer open for each velocity, it's no longer closed for each velocity subclass. Of course, for the whole system, it's, the integral is conserved, but not each velocity subclass. But that's not the reason that gives you the effect. That's important, but it's not. It's because we're looking at the interaction of these two fields. And you have to start thinking in terms of quantization of center of mass motion. Remember, how many labels do you need when you quantize the center of mass motion? Remember we did the Wigner functions? You don't remember, but you might remember a little. We need two. We have to use RR prime, RP, or PP prime. So let's imagine we're using PP prime. You start with P, and if you have this type of interaction, Chris, what do you add to that, to the atom? How many H bar Ks?
Two.
So you create a coherence in momentum space. Rho P, P plus 2 H bar K. This is no longer a population. And in fact, if you find that this does not equal constant. This is the quantity that you're interested in. It's not the total population, but it's that part that you've created, that coherence, which gives a spatial modulation of the field. Because you're only looking for the part that absorbed from this beam, emitted into this beam. And that means that that gives you a second harmonic, e to the 2ikz, which means you have a coherence between P and P plus 2h bar k. So these are the types of terms you have to start looking at when you quantize the center of mass motion. And for these terms, it's no longer closed. If you're really interested, I can give you some references. I want to look at some more as to how this comes about. Any other questions? Any other questions? We're sort of, now we're done with the first half of the course, which took a little more than half. But
you started by saying this can be used for
This is an atom interferometer now. It can be used, it doesn't have to be in the, if it's an open system, it can be used even when you don't have to quantize the center of mass motion. If it's a closed system in the absence of recoil, the signal will vanish unless you take into account recoil. And the idea is now, remember, how do we get our signal? Whatever Doppler phase we acquired here, what had to happen here? Had to cancel it. So if you change the Doppler phase, what will happen to the signal? It'll start to get destroyed, or at least it can change the phase. So if the whole thing accelerates, you'll change the phase of the relative signal.
The whole thing accelerates.
If you, it's in a gravitational field. Oh, it's a fringe of sign. And that's how you measure the acceleration of gravity, or new wave, modern wave, which is already competitive with the falling interferometers.
I thought you
just hit the falling apple. The same idea. You can also measure rotation rates this way. It'll again change the velocity and leads to a phase shift. And in the experiment I just said, when it's the recoil that's important, it turns out that the recoil is h bar k squared over 2m, because that's just the recoil associated with a photon. And the wavelength is very well known. The mass is actually pretty well known. So that lets you measure h bar. Better accuracy, probably in the near future, than has been measured before as well. The thing you need, the longer the time you can go, the more the more fringes you can get, and the better the precision you can get.
More fringes meaning that the two ground states are sort of in phase for longer?
It's that we measure this as a function of some detuning or as a function of some time separation between the pulses. We vary this time separation. And then we'll see that things that are periodic with omega k t, the recoil frequency times time. So each time you move by 1 over the recoil frequency, you get a new maximum or whatever. The pattern repeats. So if you can go out a million waves, you could do much better in determining the recoil frequency than if you have one wave. Right? The precision is essentially 1 over the time of the experiment. Any other questions? Of course, I'll do anything to avoid starting the next topic, which is more mathematical. So now we're going to talk about quantizing the field. Now, why quantize the field at all? When did you learn about quantizing the field? First grade, third grade, fifth grade. Where did you first learn about quantizing the field? You don't remember. You're too old already. See, that's why I think it could have been first grade. Quantum mechanics. And what is the, why do you quantize the field at all?
Everything else is quantized.
That's not a bad reason. You say, well, everything else is quantized. Why don't you quantize the field as well for consistency?
Classical field doesn't explain everything.
And that's sometimes used as a reason. And what doesn't the classical field explain? What's the first?
Spontaneous emission.
What's the first thing you learned? Spontaneous emission. That's the first thing you learned? What's the first evidence for a quantized field that most people learn?
Photoelectric
effect. And of course, that's no. That you could explain the photoelectric effect totally without any reference to photons. Right? Compton scattering, where you think of the particles as photons. But the Compton scattering experiments, Compton scattering calculations were done with classical fields. In fact, most calculations and most of your life, you're dealing with classical fields, and you could describe things using classical fields. The only time that it appears that you have to use quantized field is when?
When the number of photons is very small.
When the number of photons is small. When there's just a few photons in the beam. But how do you get just a few photons in the beam? Turn down the power? That doesn't work. That's the misleading thing in the photoelectric effect. What's the only guaranteed way to know that you have, quote, one photon in the beam? No?
Molecule.
You don't know. If you measure it, you can...
And you don't have any.
That's right. So you don't know what you had before, right? What's a simple way to guarantee it? You take one atom.
You're excited.
And you wait a little while. Now, what's emitted in that case?
How can you take one atom?
How can you take one atom? That's possible. You can just, you don't have to even take one atom. You can focus your detection apparatus that covers only one atom, say in an impurity. People do the single atom spectroscopy. Right? So you have some atoms in a host, and you can just focus in on that one atom. And you can ways of checking, we'll talk about it. Right? So what happens then? What does that atom do? What's the normal nomenclature? It emits a photon. Well, that's not quite true either. My advisor was Willis Lamb, and his point was that he said it's not that he's against the word photons, but he thinks it's that people should have to apply for a license to use the word. And he said most people wouldn't get it, wouldn't pass the exam. Now, we'll talk about that a little bit as well. In other words, what is a photon, and what does it mean to say photon? The word photon is used all the time. But for example, it would be more correct to say in that atom case where it emits, as it emits into a one photon state of the system. It's actually not a single photon, but a superposition of an infinite number of single photons, a single infinite number of photon states, but it's a one photon state. And we'll see what that means also. And I'll give you the prescription for quantizing the system as well. Well, we have to start with some type of classical system. That's the normal way that you quantize. You look at a classical system, and you fudge around a little, you look for some Poisson brackets, you look for something you recognize, and then you quantize the system. In the case of the electromagnetic field, we have to start with some type of system, classical system. And you already know that for a classical electromagnetic field, things will depend on the boundary conditions. If you take a boundary condition like this, and you try to quantize the field, try to find the classical fields in there, what will you find?
Yes.
Problems. Right? Even if you take a spherical cavity, which is a nice system for using angular momentum states to quantize the field, what will you find when you try to quantize those states? It's like quantizing in a spherical cavity. You get Bessel functions, you get all these combinations of Bessel functions, and things are not, the waves are not transverse. You get, it's like, someone was talking about Jackson. This is the modes inside of a spherical cavity. If you take a box, then things get a little easier, but you still have to worry about the boundary conditions at the, say, maybe the edges of the box and what's going on. It's not so clear as to what's going on. The point is, no matter what you take for your quantization volume, if you let the quantization volume grow to infinity, then things won't really depend too much on how you've chosen the quantization volume. So you might as well take the easiest one possible, or one of the easiest ones. And one of the easiest ones is a periodic boundary conditions. If you choose periodic boundary conditions, it just makes life easier. You go on for infinite space, but we'll eventually choose periodic boundary conditions. So that's the one we'll choose. However, if you're dealing with a real cavity, you may not have a choice. Inside a real cavity, what will you have to choose?
Whatever
the modes are of that cavity in order to quantize the field. This is the way that you never run into trouble. If you look at the classical problem, for example, if you have a beam splitter, which we'll do later on, you should include as your system, include the beam splitter in your system and quantize the field, get the classical modes of the field with the beam splitter in. And we'll see how to do that. And then you don't run into any problem. And then you associate with each classical mode, some quantized mode. And that's what we do. So that's the pep talk, the philosophy, and then I go through this. Most of this is in the notes. I'm not going to, it's as boring it is for you to look at it on the board, it's just as boring for me to go through it on the board. But I want to just point out some of the details and remind you of some things you may know or you haven't looked at recently that we'll need for what we're going to be doing. So we're dealing with infinite space in this case, or periodic boundary conditions eventually. So we Fourier transform any field. F is any field variable. The electric field, the magnetic field, the vector potential, something like that. And when we do that, we find this is F of kt. We find that F of minus kt is just the F of kt star. Just substitute in. F of rt, you remember, is real. So this is the transformation from f of k back to f of r. And the Hamiltonian in free space, now we'll be dealing with a free field, is just half epsilon 0 e squared plus c squared b squared. And Maxwell's equations, at least the Faraday's law and the displacement law, can be written in free space in the k space in this form. This would be normally del cross E, and this would be del cross B. But the del is replaced by K in Fourier space. So this is the starting point. Now, this Hamiltonian looks pretty familiar, almost. Something squared plus something else squared. What Hamiltonian do you have? Well, you have something squared plus something else squared. Harmonic oscillator, p squared over 2m plus 1 half kx squared. So it's tempting to think that I can assign one of these, e, for example, to momentum, an x or x to momentum, and b to e to x, q, and b to momentum, and it will look like a harmonic oscillator. Well, you can't quite do that because the commutation relations for the field are not the same as the the Poisson brackets for the field are not the same as the Poisson brackets for x and p in the harmonic oscillator. But for certain boundary conditions, it almost works out that way. So the idea, instead of doing that, is to use a little trick, is to use some combinations of E and B, and then see if we can get the Hamiltonian written in a new form that also looks quite familiar to you. So this is what we'll do. And let me get the definitions correct. So we need to take alpha of kt, which is a vector, which is minus I over 2n of k times e minus c kappa cos b. Where kappa is k over k. Kappa is a unit vector. And these are tildes. So these are still in Fourier space. N is just a normalization. We can choose it any way we want. It's just a number we're putting in. And we'll choose it for some convenience in a few minutes. I did the calculations carrying it all the way through to show you that there's nothing magical with N, but then I decided that it's not worth all that. So you can choose N anything you want, but it'll just eventually, everything will scale with N, and we choose it in a certain way to give familiar results. No, everything is SI. SI, that's the wave of the future, right? Even Jackson's new edition, which he's writing, he's going to write in SI units. Everyone will have to buy a new edition. And what we also want is alpha star of minus k and t equals I over nk E tilde plus C kappa cross B tilde. How do we get that? Remember, we use this property of the fields in order to get that, and K changes to minus K, so that changes this sign. So when we do this, we can write down the fields. E is 2IIN times alpha of KT minus alpha star of kt, or minus kt. And b is I n alpha of kt plus alpha star of minus kt. So these are the fields in terms of these quantities, alpha and alpha star, which I'm going to introduce because they're going to lead to something familiar. But you notice, first of all, since we're in free fields, what about E, B, and alpha star? They're all perpendicular to K. Now we'll need to use that. So now, essentially, we can write down the Hamiltonian in terms of alpha and alpha star. Here's our Hamiltonian in K-space. So what do? You substitute in. And remember, when I'm integrating over K, what can I always do? I can change K to minus K, and doesn't change the integral at all. So I can make that substitution when I need to. So what do you get when you substitute here? When I get the E squared terms, what do I get? I get terms like alpha star, alpha complex conjugate, this times this complex conjugate. And what do you imagine when I add these together? What about the cross terms? The cross terms cancel. And what about the contribution from E and B? you know, for a plane wave, contribution to the energy from the E field and the B field?
Same.
It's the same. So we're just going to get a factor of 2, which will cancel this factor of 2, and we end up, the details are wherever in your head on the sheets. So we have now an integral of n of k squared, and now we have alpha of kt alpha star of kt. Let me just use the same notation I'm using again. And remember, when you take the, when you put in b, remember, well, this b is wrong. This should be capital plus alpha. These are kappa cross alphas in here. And that came from using this relationship that we have to take. If I use the fact that k is perpendicular to b and e, I can, when I invert this, I can multiply by k on both sides to get this relationship.
I think
you
use c as well.
C. IN over C. So it's alpha alpha star plus alpha star alpha. Now why do I do this? Clearly that's just 2 alpha. But I'm going to want to leave it in some type of symmetrized form so that when I try to quantize the system, I'm able to quantize it. So this just comes now, and this is dot, really. These are vectors. So this is the Hamiltonian that we have. Class, everything is classical so far. What equation of motion does alpha obey? Just equal to IH bar times minus I over 2nk times the partial of E with respect to T. What is that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I C squared K.
Partial of E, I C squared K cross B. And then we have minus C kappa cross, what's the partial of B with respect to T?
Minus
I K cross C. So what does K cross E give us? I'm going to use the back cab rule. All right, you don't have to. It's K times K dot E. But what is K dot E?
It's
0. 0, because K is perpendicular, and then you get minus E times K dot K. But K dot K is, kappa is just
zero.
K. K dot kappa. Kappa is in the direction of K.
Oh.
So it's just K. So what, without going through all the details, what does this term give you just back? E. And what does this term give you?
E.
K cross B. No, K cross B. So we're back to what we started with. Kappa cross B and E. And what's the multiplication factor? It's just CK. And what is CK?
Omega.
Omega. So this is just equal to, I have to put IH bar. So this is IH bar times minus I omega alpha. I'll try to use J's to distinguish, to remind you that it's not the same I as the complex I. So in other words, alpha j dot equals minus I omega j alpha j. This is the equation for the in free space for these alphas. This is totally equivalent to Maxwell's equation, this equation for alpha, and the corresponding equation for alpha star. Now, they're the independent quantities. So I have alpha star, since alpha is complex, alpha star dot j equals I omega j. These are equivalent to Maxwell's equations. You can work in alpha space or in E and B space. So this will now let us quantize the system. So let's do that, and then we'll probably quit for today. Let's at least start with that.
Excuse me?
Yes?
To relate it to the mode?
We haven't yet quantized, remember. This is just, everything is totally classical now. Each B and E, remember, since we're using periodic boundary conditions, what modes are possible?
It's plane wave.
All plane waves. So each K corresponds, and we actually have to introduce some polarization, each K corresponds to how many independent modes, essentially?
Two.
You have two independent polarizations. So let me choose n now. Right value here. I want to choose n squared equals h bar omega over 2 epsilon 0 times L over 2 pi cubed. Where L is the length of our quantization bubble. Of course, L goes to infinity.
Isn't the number of modes?
This is just a normalization factor. Remember, it could have been anything. If you're not happy with this, keep the n in the equations all the way through. And at the end, you can choose anything you want. I'm just choosing it this way. So if we put that in, what do we find for h? It's an integral of h bar omega over 2 epsilon 0 L over 2 pi cubed alpha star alpha plus alpha alpha star. Now I'm taking out the dots, but in principle what you should do is put in a polarization for each mode and then dot the epsilons so that this will be there as well. And that's in the notes. So this is starting to look familiar. Now what we do is we go over from an integral to a sum. Let's use periodic boundary conditions. So what is kx in this case? In periodic boundary conditions. It's 2 pi nx over L. So we're interested in an integral of some function of k dk. Let's just do it in one dimension. And then we'll see what it is in three dimensions. So this is essentially f of k1 delta k plus f of k2 delta k, etc. That's what we mean by an integral. But what is delta k?
2 pi over
L. Just 2 pi over L. We just change n by 1. So this is a sum of f of ki times 2 pi over L. So that tells us how to go from an integral to a sum. What do we simply multiply by? 2 pi over L cubed, and we take the sum. So h now goes to a sum, and I had to put the epsilon 0 here, so that cancels, of 1 half h bar omega j times alpha star j alpha j plus alpha j alpha star j. Still classical. This is totally equivalent to our original Hamiltonian in terms of E squared plus B squared. But now what we do is we notice the following. This is a homework problem, but I'll do it today anyway. So short, we take the partial of A with respect to alpha, J. What is that? H bar omega J times what? Alpha J star. But what is alpha J star? In terms of alpha J star dot. This is just I H bar alpha J star. Remember, because alpha j star dot is I omega j alpha j star. So I just solve for alpha j star, it's alpha j star dot over I omega j, and we have a minus minus. Well, this is starting to look encouraging. If we now take this whole thing, we take the partial of A with respect to minus I, I'm sorry, with respect to I H bar alpha J star, what do we find? That's just 1 over I H bar times H bar omega J alpha J. But what does that equal? That's minus I omega J alpha J. But what is minus I omega J alpha J just simply? Alpha J dot. Partial of H with respect to one variable equals minus the other variable dot. Partial with respect to H with the second variable equals the first variable dot. These are what? Not P's and Q's, but they're canonical variables. So we see that alpha J and I H bar alpha J star are canonical variables. So that means that plus on bracket is unity. And what's a way of quantizing them? You're never guaranteed. You know, you can, it's like differential equations. You can do anything you want to quantize a system. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, then you find the reason why it didn't work. But if we take the Poisson bracket and now let it become a commutator, what do we have to set then? Alpha J comma I H bar alpha J star now goes to AJ, some quantum mechanical operators, comma I H bar AJ dagger. And what must that commutator equal? We use our normal quantization procedures. Whenever you have the Poisson bracket, you set the commutator equal to IH bar. So what does that tell us? That AJ comma AJ dagger equals 1. And that's why we took the N the way I did, so that you end up just getting this value for the commutator. If not, we get a different value, and all the equations will be scaled by n. Would make a difference. So this is the fundamental commutator relationship. And again, of course, for a I comma a j dagger equals delta I j. Not in the same mode, you get the commutator vanishes. So
what change to a?
A, we change from the classical variables alpha now to quantum mechanical operators alpha, A, and A dagger. That's how we make the transformation. That's the normal way of quantizing. To each classical variable, we associate a quantum mechanical operator. So that's what we're doing. And now we can write our Hamiltonian. This anymore. H equals 1/2 sum of H bar omega j, AJ dagger, AJ plus AJ, AJ dagger. Which is the sum of H bar omega j, AJ dagger, AJ plus a half. Well, what Hamiltonian is this? You're familiar with this? Harmonic oscillator. Hamiltonian, so that we know how to deal with this harmonic oscillator potential. Hamiltonian. We know how to get the eigenstates. I don't want to go through and bore you, but I'll remind you, how do you deal with this Hamiltonian? Do you remember what you did in quantum mechanics to get the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian?
Do the raising and lowering.
Yeah, and how did you do that? And that's right. How did you do the raising and lowering? Remember? This is something to remember. That's why I want to remind you of this if you don't remember it.
What do you mean?
How did you get the raising and lowering operators? What did you consider? You take H A minus A H, and what is that equal to? Let's just take a single mode. What's the commutator of H with A? Let's take a single mode. So let's say H equals H bar omega A dagger A plus a half. What's H comma A? Just do it. It's A dagger. First of all, a half commutes with A. You don't have to worry about that. A dagger A. A dagger A comma A. What is that? It's been a long time. At least... Remember how to do this? You take one this out to this side, you take this out to this side, A comma A is zero. When you take this out, you get A dagger comma A.
A dagger A is one, or is it minus one? A dagger A is
one.
So it's minus A.
Yeah.
All right? So what does that mean? If I look at HA minus A, operating on A. In other words, I can call this whole operator, new operator, N. And I can, I don't have to do that, but I can say H operating on an eigenket, N, let me not call that N, H operating on an eigenket, N, equals H bar omega, N plus a half, N. This is perfectly general. N could be anything. It doesn't have to be an integer at this stage. It's just any number. I'm just writing it in this form, in this way, parameterizing it. So if I write HA minus AH operating on a state N, what is that equal to? Minus A operating on N. But what is H operating on N? H bar omega N plus a half. So if I end up, I look, and I find that HA operating on N from this term, I bring this to the other side, I get simply, this is equal to N minus 1 plus a half A N from this. Right? But what is this? Imply. What does this imply? This is, you're supposed to have had, this is your harmonic oscillator, right? An is an eigenstate of H with an eigenvalue? N minus 1. So what does that mean? That means An A n It's just some constant times n minus 1. And similarly, if I look at the commutator of h and a dagger, I get a raising operator, and I find that a dagger operating on n equals some cn prime times n plus 1. And then I can look at a dagger a. If I take this times its adjoint, what do I get? I get n a dagger a n equals cn squared times 1, n minus 1 times n, assuming they're normalized. But what is this simply?
Number.
Gives me the number operator n, so this just gives me n. So that cn equals the square root of n, cn prime equals the square root of n plus 1. So this is what an, I assume this is familiar to most of you at some point, even if you don't admit it, that these are the raising and lowering operators, and this is what the raising and lowering operators do to the ket's n and n, to the ket n. And then what's the next step? E is positive definite, because it's written as h bar omega a dagger a plus a half. So you know that all the eigenvalues have to be what? Positive. Greater than zero. So you keep on applying a, the operator a, until you get down to the lowest eigenvalue, has to kill it, and that shows you that the lowest eigenvalue is has to be n equals zero. And that, so you end up finding that the eigenkets of this Hamiltonian can be written simply as n, where n equals 0, 1, 2, etc. And these now, in the case of the harmonic oscillator, what were they called? These states? Number states, right? In the case of the radiation field, what are these states called now? Photons. N means the number of photons in a given mode of the field. So this is the quantization procedure. You get a classical box, you find the classical modes, and to each classical mode, you essentially apply an H bar omega A dagger A in the Hamiltonian. So let's stop here. Now you can review this if you've forgotten it before next lecture. Next time I'll start to talk about some properties of these photon states. And we'll talk about what are called coherent states. I'm not going to do the phase operator in any detail. The phase operator is in the notes. And Mandel knows a lot more about phase operators than I do. And he's worked on that extensively. So if you look at Mandel and Wolf, he has both, which I'll talk about, the Peg Barnett definition of the phase operator and what he's developed himself, which are called operational measures of the phase operator, which disagrees somewhat from the Peg Barnett. But there's a discussion in his book about that. After that, I'll talk about coherent states, and then we'll talk about two-photon coherent states or squeeze states. Okay.
So as your side question, you were talking about.
Well, one question at a time, right?
You're talking about how the advisor said that.
Lamb said that you need a license.
Does that have to do with coherent states?
The coherent states are strange states, but it has to do with people talk about photons.
Yeah.
But you rarely ever, if you had a single photon state here, it would be in all of space.
Yeah.
It couldn't interact with any level. So what Lamb, I think, would agree to is that the proper way to, what you call a photon, are the corresponding excitations that correspond to classical modes of the boundary value problem. If you associate with each of those modes something, quantum excitation, which you call photon, you never have any problems.
How about
cn equals square root of n? Here?
Yeah.
Well, a dagger a is just n.
Oh.
Operating on this.
Okay.
A gamma ray is just, remember, this is H. This is H minus the half, right? And we know what H does for the state.
We can fill it out together.
Just as a half.
Five, five.
Okay. It's N plus a half. We'll subtract off the half.
I don't know.
All right, now I supposed to meet with you and Cindy today. Now there's a faculty meeting. If you want to come by at 1, are you free?
I can't remember. It's
right, if you both come by 1, I can help you about the
that's
project.
That's what I was thinking. It's not
you about your homework.
See?
Next time we'll just write, remember we've already done that.
Because
it's not supposed to be that, but we wrote E in terms of alpha and alpha star.
Yeah, but the E and B never stood.
They were credible. The only thing we have to do is replace the alpha by A and the alpha star by a dagger.
And there's still nothing that would change between the sort of classical B and E.
No, that's how we go from them. There are changes, but that's how we go from a classical E and B to a quantized E and B by replacing A and A dagger. So we'll see that, for example, the energy in the field is infinite, even if you're in the vacuum state, which is not the case in a classical field. So there are a lot of embarrassments that occur when you use this definition. And who knows if 100 years from now we'll have the same vacuum still poses a lot of problems. People have tried to avoid this by other techniques, but none have been successful.
Haven't people tried to try to get the vacuum energy experimentally?
Well, you can never measure the infinite energy. You always measure differences, right?
Right. Utilize the vacuum.
Is that CO1 cup?
You can utilize the vacuum, but it's all hype. I mean, you're inside a cavity, you have vacuum fields, and you can see the effects on an atom when you send it in. You can get a force on an atom and things like that. So the Casimir force is usually referred to as an indication of it's a totally quantum mechanical effect. So that may be some justification. You have to look at effects that don't disappear as H bar goes to zero. Casimir effect is one such effect. You're modifying the vacuum by putting the plates and causes a force between the plates. But I haven't thought about that enough. I'm still, it seems to me
letter.
And there's a whole group that is not so popular anymore, but there's a whole group of people who claim that all the quantum properties of the fields are always related to quantum properties of matter rather than the field. So that's for the atoms. Remember, we said if we excited one atom, it would emit a single photon state. But it's really the property of that field is related to the fact that we started with a quantized atom. So there are theories that will, I don't know if we'll get there this semester, but what you can do is you can eliminate the field. You can eliminate the vacuum field in some sense and write the electric field totally in terms of, say, atomic operators.
And that's what's
called source field. That's called source field theory. But these are quantized operators so that you represent the quantized electric field in terms of the atomic operators. And that shows you that all the quantum properties of the field are in some sense related to the quantum properties of the atoms.
Can you spend any time, are we going to spend any time talking about that? Because that's the piece I seem to be missing to understand why coherence, you mentioned that coherent states have to do with the absorption.
All right.
Well, at least we talked about it in field theory or whatever we call it.
I had a problem with my eye.
It was confusing to me at first why.
Why
you'd be interested in an operator that doesn't have eigenvalues?
Coherent states. That's something else.
Doesn't that relate to absorption?
It does relate to it, but coherent states are these weird things. I mean, Glauber, when he invented them or used them, at least said, people were very skeptical. But what you can show is if you have any classical current distribution, it generates a coherent state of the field.
Well, maybe it'll make more sense.
But we'll talk about coherent states is different. I mean, we'll talk about what a coherent state is simply defined such, we'll do next time, such that its expectation values give you the classical field values.
Okay.
That's the way it's defined, so that it's as close to a classical field as we can make it by demanding that. But when we demand that, we see that it has a very strange property, that they're defined by the annihilation operator acting on a coherent state.
Gives back the
same state. So if you destroyed a photon, how can you be back in the same state?
That's what I need help with. So.
Bye. Okay, you all set?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye.